were handwritten notes on top-secret material. Typed notes were sewn into a cushion. Bettany was strangely contrite. I have put the service in a bloody position. It wasn't my intention. The uncovering of yet another mole inside the British spy establishment was portrayed as a triumph for the security service. Margaret Thatcher congratulated MI5's Director General on how well the case had been handled. The Nadja sent a personal message to Gordievsky, emphasizing how warmly we feel about him. And Gordievsky sent a message back, through Spooner, saying that he hoped one day to thank the officers of MI5 in person. I don't know whether such a day will come or not. Maybe not. Nevertheless, I would like this idea to be recorded somewhere. They have underlined my belief that they are the real defenders of democracy in the most direct sense of the word. Margaret Thatcher was the only member of the cabinet aware of Gordievsky's role in catching the British spy. Inside British intelligence, only the Nadjas knew what had really happened. With the press in a frenzy, some judicious disinformation was spread suggesting that the tip-off about Bettany's treachery had come from signals intelligence, i.e. wiretaps, or that the Russians themselves had told the security service about the spy in its midst. One newspaper reported, wrongly, the Russians in London grew tired of Bettany's approaches to them and, believing that he was a classic agent provocateur, told MI5 that Bettany was wasting his time. It was then that MI5 began investigating Bettany. In case there might be another spy within, and to divert attention away from the real source, MI5 faked up a report for the files, suggesting that the leak about Bettany's approach had come from a regular diplomat in the Soviet embassy. The Soviets denied everything, and insisted that the talk of KGB espionage was cynically fabricated propaganda, aimed at damaging the normal development of Soviet-British relations. Inside the KGB station, Cook clung to his belief that the whole charade had been orchestrated by MI5 to embarrass him. To do otherwise would have been to admit a blunder of staggering proportions. Gordievsky detected no hint of suspicion as to the real source of Bettany's exposure. I do not think Cook or Nikitenko ever connected me with Koba. Amid all the speculation and the reams of newsprint devoted to the sensational Bettany case, the truth never once broke the surface, that the man in Brixton prison awaiting trial on 10 counts of violating the Official Secrets Act had been put there by Oleg Gordievsky. Chapter 10. Mr. Collins and Mrs. Thatcher. The Iron Lady had developed a soft spot for her Russian spy. Margaret Thatcher had never met Oleg Gordievsky. She did not know his name, and referred to him, inexplicably and insistently, as Mr. Collins. She knew he spied from within the Russian embassy, worried about the personal strain he was under, and reflected that he might jump at any time and defect. If that moment came, the Prime Minister insisted, he and his family must be properly cared for. The Russian agent was no mere intelligence egg-layer, she said, but a heroic, half-imagined figure working for freedom under conditions of extreme peril. His reports were conveyed by her private secretary, numbered and marked top secret and personal, and UK Eyes A, meaning they were not to be shared with other countries. The Prime Minister consumed them avidly. She would read word for word, annotate, pose questions, and the papers came back with her marks over them, underlinings, exclamation marks, and comments. In the words of her biographer, Charles Moore, Thatcher was not above being excited by secrecy in itself and by the romance of espionage. But she was also conscious that the Russian was furnishing uniquely precious political insight. Gordievsky's dispatches conveyed to her, as no other information had done, how the Soviet leadership reacted to Western phenomena and, indeed, to her. The spy opened a window into Kremlin thinking, which she peered through with fascination and gratitude. Probably no British Prime Minister has ever followed the case of a British agent with as much personal attention as Mrs. Thatcher devoted to Gordievsky. While British intelligence had been hunting for Koba, the KGB was working hard to try to ensure that Thatcher lost the 1983 general election. In the eyes of the Kremlin, Thatcher was the Iron Lady, a nickname intended as an insult by the Soviet Army newspaper that coined it, but one in which she reveled. And the KGB had been organizing active measures to undermine her ever since she came to power in 1979, including the placing of negative articles with sympathetic left-wing journalists. The KGB still had contacts on the left, and Moscow clung to the illusion that it might be able to influence the election in favor of the Labour Party, whose leader, after all, was still listed in KGB files as a confidential contact. In an intriguing harbinger of modern times, Moscow was prepared to use dirty tricks and hidden interference to swing a democratic election in favor of its chosen candidate. Had Labour won, Gordievsky would have found himself in a truly bizarre position, passing KGB secrets to a government whose prime minister had once been the willing recipient of KGB cash. In the end, Michael Foot's earlier incarnation as Agent Boot remained a closely held secret. KGB efforts to swing the election had no impact whatever, and on June 9th, Margaret Thatcher won by a landslide, boosted by victory in the Falklands the year before. Armed with a new mandate and secretly equipped with Gordievsky's insights into Kremlin psychology, Thatcher turned her sights to the Cold War. What she saw was deeply alarming. In the latter half of 1983, East and West seemed to be heading into armed and perhaps terminal conflict, propelled by a potentially lethal combination of Reaganite rhetoric and Soviet paranoia. Speaking to the Houses of Parliament, the American president promised to leave Marxism-Leninism on the ash heap of history. The U.S. military buildup continued apace, accompanied by a range of PSYOPs, psychological operations, including penetrations into Soviet airspace and clandestine naval operations, demonstrating how close NATO could get to Russian military bases. These were designed to stoke Russian anxiety, and they succeeded. The Ryan program moved up a gear, as KGB stations were bombarded with orders to find evidence that the United States and NATO were preparing a surprise nuclear attack. In August, a personal telegram from the head of the First Chief Directorate, later the KGB's chief, Vladimir Kyutkov, instructed residenturas to monitor preparations for war, such as the secret infiltration of sabotage teams with nuclear, bacteriological and chemical weapons into the Soviet Union. KGB stations that dutifully reported suspicious activity were praised. Those that did not were sharply criticized and told to do better. Gook was forced to admit shortcomings in his efforts to uncover specific American and NATO plans for the preparation of surprise nuclear missile attack against the USSR. Gordievsky dismissed Operation Ryan as farcical, but his reports to MI6 left no room for doubt. The Soviet leadership was genuinely fearful, braced for combat, and panicky enough to believe that its survival might depend on preemptive action, a situation that grew dramatically worse following a tragic accident over the Sea of Japan. In the early hours of September 1st, 1983, a Soviet interceptor aircraft shot down a Korean Airlines 747 that had strayed into Soviet airspace, killing all 269 passengers and crew. The shooting down of KAL Flight 007 sent East-West relations plummeting to a dangerous new low. Moscow initially denied any role in the shootdown, but then claimed the airliner was a spy plane that had violated Soviet airspace in a deliberate provocation by the United States. Ronald Reagan condemned the Korean airline massacre as an act of barbarism and inhuman brutality, stoking domestic and international outrage and luxuriating in what one U.S. official later called the joy of total self-righteousness. Congress agreed to a further increase in defense spending. Moscow, in turn, interpreted Western anger over KAL 007 as manufactured moral hysteria, preparatory to an attack. Instead of an apology, the Kremlin accused the CIA of a criminal provocative act. A volley of most urgent flash telegrams arrived at the London KGB station, with instructions to protect Soviet assets and citizens against possible attack, pin the blame on America, and collect information to bolster Moscow's conspiracy theories. The London KGB station was later commended by the center for its efforts to counteract the anti-Soviet campaign over the South Korean airliner. Ailing and bedridden with what would prove to be his final illness, Andropov lashed out at what he called America's outrageous militarist psychosis. Gordievsky smuggled the telegrams out of the embassy and passed them to MI6. The downing of KAL-007 was the consequence of basic human incompetence on the part of two pilots, one Korean and one Russian. But Gordievsky's reporting to MI6 clearly showed how, under the pressure of escalating tension and mutual incomprehension, an ordinary tragedy had exacerbated an extraordinarily dangerous political situation. Into this stew of ferocious mistrust, misunderstanding, and aggression came an event that took the Cold War to the brink of actual war. Abel Archer 83 was the codename for a NATO war game, held from November 2nd to 11th, 1983, intended to simulate an escalating conflict, culminating in a nuclear attack. This sort of military dress rehearsal had been held many times in the past by both sides. Abel Archer involved 40,000 US and other NATO troops in Western Europe, deployed and coordinated through encrypted communications. The command post training exercise imagined a situation in which the Blue Forces, NATO, defended its allies after Orange Forces, Warsaw Pact countries, sent troops into Yugoslavia before invading Finland, Norway, and eventually Greece. As the make-believe conflict intensified, a conventional war would seem to escalate into one involving chemical and nuclear weapons, enabling NATO to practice nuclear release procedures. No real weapons were deployed. This was a dummy run. But in the febrile atmosphere following the KAL-007 incident, Kremlin alarmists saw something much more sinister. A ruse intended to cover up preparations for the real thing. A nuclear first strike of the sort that Andropov had been predicting and Operation Ryan had been seeking for more than 3 years. NATO began to simulate a realistic nuclear assault at the very moment the KGB was attempting to detect one. Various unprecedented features of Abel Archer reinforced Soviet suspicions that this was more than a game. A burst of secret communications between the US and UK a month earlier, in fact, a response to the US invasion of Grenada, the initial participation of Western leaders, and different patterns of officer movements at US bases in Europe. The cabinet secretary, Sir Robert Armstrong, later briefed Mrs. Thatcher that the Soviets had responded with such deep alarm because the exercise took place over a major Soviet holiday and had the form of actual military activity and alerts, not just wargaming. On November 5th, the London Residentura received a telegram from the center warning that once the US and NATO decided to launch a first strike, their missiles would be airborne in 7 to 10 days. Cook was ordered to carry out urgent surveillance to detect any unusual activity in key locations: nuclear bases, communications centers, government bunkers, and, above all, 10 Downing Street, where officials would be working frantically to prepare for war without informing the press. In an instruction that says much about its own priorities, the KGB instructed its officers to monitor evidence that members of the political, economic, and military elite were evacuating their own families from London. The telegram, passed by Gordievsky to MI6, was the first indication received by the West that the Soviets were responding to the exercise in an unusual and deeply alarming way. 2, or perhaps 3 days later, a second flash telegram was sent to KGB Residenturas, reporting, erroneously, that American bases had been placed on alert. The center offered various explanations, one of which was that the countdown to a nuclear first strike had begun under the cover of Abel Archer. In fact, the bases were merely tightening security following the terrorist attack on American service personnel in Beirut. The intelligence from Gordievsky came too late for the West to stop the exercise. By this point, the Soviet Union had begun preparing its own nuclear arsenal. Aircraft in East Germany and Poland were fitted with nuclear weapons. Around 70 SS-20 missiles targeted on Western Europe were placed on heightened alert, and Soviet submarines, carrying nuclear ballistic missiles, were deployed under the Arctic ice to avoid detection. The CIA reported military activity in the Baltic states and Czechoslovakia. Some analysts believe that the Soviet Union actually readied its ICBM silos, preparatory to launch, but held back from doing so at the last moment. On November 11th, Abel Archer wound down on schedule. The two sides slowly lowered their guns, and a terrifying Mexican standoff, unnecessary and unnoticed by the general public, came to an end. Historians disagree on just how close the world had come to war. The authorized history of MI5 describes Abel Archer as the most dangerous moment since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Others argue that Moscow knew all along that this was merely an exercise, and that Soviet nuclear war preparations were merely shadow boxing of a familiar sort. Gordievsky himself was phlegmatic. I felt that this was a further and disturbing reflection of the increasing paranoia in Moscow, not a cause of urgent concern in the absence of other indications. But within the British government, those who read Gordievsky's reports and the stream of telegrams from Moscow believed nuclear catastrophe had been narrowly averted. In the words of Geoffrey Howe, Britain's foreign secretary, Gordievsky left us in no doubt of the extraordinary but genuine Russian fear of a real-life nuclear strike. NATO deliberately changed some aspects of the exercise so as to leave the Soviets in no doubt that it was only an exercise. In fact, by departing from standard practice, NATO may have compounded the impression of sinister intent. A subsequent report by the Joint Intelligence Committee, JIC, concluded, "We cannot discount the possibility that at least some Soviet officials/officers may have misinterpreted Abel Archer as posing a real threat." Margaret Thatcher was deeply worried. The combination of Soviet fears and Reaganite rhetoric might have ended in nuclear war, but America was not fully aware of a situation it had partly created. "Something must be done," she ordered, "to remove the danger that, by miscalculating Western intentions, the Soviet Union would overreact. The Foreign Office must urgently consider how to approach the Americans on the question of possible Soviet misapprehensions about a surprise NATO attack." MI6 agreed to share Gordievsky's revelations with the Americans. The distribution of knock-done material moved up another gear. MI6 specifically told the CIA that the KGB thought a war game had been a deliberate prelude to the outbreak of war. "I don't see how they could believe that," said Ronald Reagan, when told that the Kremlin had genuinely feared a nuclear attack during Abel Archer. "But it's something to think about." In fact, the U.S. president had already given considerable thought to the prospect of nuclear apocalypse. A month earlier, he was greatly depressed after watching The Day After, a film about an American Midwestern city destroyed in a nuclear attack. Shortly after Abel Archer, he attended a Pentagon briefing depicting the fantastically horrible impact of a nuclear war. Even if America won such a conflict, 150 million American lives would probably be lost. Reagan described the briefing as the most sobering experience. That night he noted in his diary, "I feel the Soviets are so paranoid about being attacked that we ought to tell them no one here has any intention of doing anything like that." Both Reagan and Thatcher understood the Cold War in terms of a communist threat to peaceful Western democracy. Thanks to Gordievsky, they were now aware that the Soviet anxiety might represent a greater danger to the world than Soviet aggression. In his memoirs, Reagan wrote, "3 years had taught me something surprising about the Russians. Many people at the top of the Soviet hierarchy were genuinely afraid of America and Americans. I began to realize that many Soviet officials feared us not only as adversaries, but as potential aggressors, who might hurl nuclear weapons at them in a first strike." Abel Archer marked a turning point, a moment of terrifying Cold War confrontation, undetected by the Western media and public, that triggered a slow but perceptible thaw. The Reagan administration began to moderate its anti-Soviet rhetoric. Thatcher resolved to reach out to Moscow. She felt the time had come to move beyond the rhetoric of the evil empire and think how the West could bring the Cold War to an end, according to a senior advisor. Kremlin paranoia started to abate, particularly after the death of Andropov in February 1984, and though KGB officers were told to remain alert for signs of nuclear preparation, the momentum of Operation Ryan began to wane. Gordievsky was partly responsible. Hitherto, his secrets had been doled out to the U.S. in small, highly selective bits and pieces, and from now on, his intelligence haul would be shared with the CIA in ever larger chunks, though still carefully camouflaged. The information about Soviet alarm during Able Archer was said to have come from a Czechoslovak intelligence officer tasked with monitoring major NATO exercises. Gordievsky was happy for MI6 to share his intelligence with the CIA. Oleg wanted it, said one of his British handlers. He wanted to make an impact, and he did. The CIA had several spies in the USSR, but no source able to provide this kind of real insight into Soviet psychology, and supply original documents which betrayed a genuine nervousness that a preemptive strike could take place at any time. Robert Gates, Deputy Director of Intelligence at the CIA, read the reports based on Gordievsky's intelligence and realized the agency had missed a trick. My first reaction to the reporting was not only that we might have had a major intelligence failure, but further, that the most terrifying thing about Able Archer was that we may have been at the brink of nuclear war and not even known it. According to a secret internal CIA summary of the Able Archer scare, written several years later, Gordievsky's information was an epiphany for President Reagan. Only Gordievsky's timely warning to Washington via MI6 kept things from going too far. From Able Archer onward, the essence of Gordievsky's political reporting was passed to Ronald Reagan in the form of a regular summary, clearly flowing from a single agent. Gates wrote, with hindsight, "Our sources in the Soviet Union tended to be those who provided us with information about their military and military R&D. What Gordievsky was giving us was information about the thinking of the leadership, and that kind of information was, for us, as scarce as hen's teeth." Reagan was very moved by what he read, knowing that it came from an individual risking his life from somewhere deep within the Soviet system. The information from MI6 was treated as the holy of holies in the CIA, seen only by a small group who read it in hard copy under strict conditions, before being repackaged and sent to the Oval Office. Gordievsky's intelligence underpinned Reagan's conviction that a greater effort had to be made not just to reduce tension, but to end the Cold War. The CIA was appreciative but frustrated, deeply curious as to where this steady stream of secrets could be coming from. Spies tend to make extravagant claims for their craft, but the reality of espionage is that it frequently makes little lasting difference. Politicians treasure classified information because it is secret, which does not necessarily render it more reliable than openly accessible information, and frequently makes it less so. If the enemy has spies in your camp and you have spies in his, the world may be a little safer, but essentially you end up where you started, somewhere on the arcane and unquantifiable spectrum of "I know that you know that I know." Yet very occasionally, spies have a profound impact on history. The breaking of the Enigma Code shortened the Second World War by at least a year. Successful espionage and strategic deception underpinned the Allied invasion of Sicily and the D-Day landings. The Soviet penetration of Western intelligence in the 1930s and 1940s gave Stalin a crucial advantage in his dealings with the West. The pantheon of world-changing spies is small and select, and Oleg Gordievsky is in it. He opened up the inner workings of the KGB at a pivotal juncture in history, revealing not just what Soviet intelligence was doing and not doing, but what the Kremlin was thinking and planning, and in so doing, transformed the way the West thought about the Soviet Union. He risked his life to betray his country, and made the world a little safer. As a classified internal CIA review put it, the Able Archer scare was the last paroxysm of the Cold War. Thousands of people filled Red Square for the funeral of Yuri Andropov on February 14, 1984. Among the international dignitaries in attendance was Margaret Thatcher, clad in elegant morning dress and looking slightly stouter than usual, thanks to a hot water bottle tucked beneath her coat to ward off the Moscow chill. The funeral, she had told Vice President George Bush, was a godsend for East-West relations. She put on a bravura show, while other Western leaders chattered inattentively during the funeral and even sniggered when Andropov's coffin was dropped by bearers, she remained suitably solemn throughout. A burly British bodyguard, his pockets bulging with what the KGB assumed to be weaponry, followed her back to the reception at the Kremlin and then whipped out a pair of high-heeled shoes for the Prime Minister to change into. She spent 40 minutes talking to Andropov's successor, the elderly and ailing Konstantin Chernenko, and told him they had a chance, perhaps the last chance, of securing fundamental disarmament agreements. Chernenko struck her as astonishingly ancient, a living fossil of the communist past. "For heaven's sake, try and find me a young Russian," she told aides in the plane on the way home. In fact, officials had already identified someone who might fit the bill as an interlocutor on the Soviet side, a rising star in the Politburo named Mikhail Gorbachev. Thatcher had played her role perfectly, following a script that had been written in part by Gordievsky. Before the funeral, James Spooner asked him for tips on how Thatcher should aim to present herself. Gordievsky urged decorum and friendliness, but warned that the Russians were touchy and defensive. "Oleg provided a full briefing on how she should conduct herself," said the MI6 officer responsible for analyzing and distributing the product from the case. On the rostrum, she wore a black dress and a fur hat, and looked very serious. It was a seductive performance. She had an insight into their psychology. Without Oleg, she would have been much tougher. Because of Oleg, she knew how best to play her hand. They noticed. Back at the Soviet embassy in London, Ambassador Popov told a meeting of embassy staff, including the KGB contingent, that Mrs. Thatcher's attendance at the funeral had gone down extremely well in Moscow. "The Prime Minister's sensitivity to the occasion and formidable political brain has made a deep impression," Popov reported. "Mrs. Thatcher has gone out of her way to charm her hosts." Here was a perfect intelligence cycle. Gordievsky was briefing the Prime Minister on how to respond to the Soviets, and then reporting back the Soviet reaction to that behavior. Spies usually furnish facts, leaving the recipient to analyze them. With his unique perspective, Gordievsky was able to interpret for the West what the KGB was thinking, hoping, and fearing. "That is the essence of Oleg's contribution," said the MI6 analyst. "Getting inside the minds of others, getting into their logic, their rationality." Gordievsky's espionage was both positive and negative. In its positive form, it supplied important secrets, advance warnings, and insight. In its negative but equally useful form, it offered reassurance that the KGB station in Britain was, by and large, hopeless, as lumbering, inefficient, and mendacious as the man who ran it. Arkady Guk scorned his bosses back at the center, but rushed to fulfill their demands, however ludicrous. When he heard on the BBC that a cruise missile exercise had taken place at Greenham Common, the resident hastened to manufacture a report, indicating that he had known about the test beforehand. When mass anti-nuclear demonstrations took place in Britain, Guk claimed credit by insisting, falsely, that the KGB's active measures had prompted the protests. Two suicides of Soviet citizens in London, one in the trade delegation and the other the wife of an official, thrust Guk's suspicions into overdrive. He sent the bodies back to Moscow, with orders to establish whether they had been poisoned, which the KGB scientists obediently confirmed, even though one had hanged himself and the other had thrown herself off a balcony. Here, thought Gordievsky, was yet another sign of how Soviet paranoia was feeding off its own neuroses. The KGB resident carefully covered up his own incompetence over the Bettany case, assuring Moscow that it was all an elaborate ruse cooked up by British intelligence. Guk jealously guarded his secrets, yet Gordievsky was able to pick up an astonishing quantity of useful information, ranging from embassy gossip to information of political and national significance. The KGB ran a number of illegals in Britain, and although Line N operated semi-independently within the Residentura, Gordievsky tipped off MI5 whenever he picked up information about the underground spy network. At the height of the miners' strike, in 1984-85, Gordievsky learned that the National Union of Mine Workers, NUM, had contacted Moscow to request financial support. The KGB opposed funding the miners. Gordievsky himself told KGB colleagues that it would be undesirable and unproductive for Moscow to be seen bankrolling industrial action. But the Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party thought otherwise, and approved the transfer of more than $1 million from the Soviet Foreign Trade Bank. In the end, the Swiss receiving bank became suspicious, and the transfer never happened. Thatcher vilified the miners as the enemy within, a prejudice no doubt reinforced by the discovery that the enemy without was prepared to finance their strike. Gordievsky's espionage radar was able to pick up other enemies, far from Moscow. On April 17, 1984, a woman police officer named Yvonne Fletcher was killed by machine gun fire from the Libyan People's Bureau in St. James's Square in central London. The next day, the KGB Residentura received a telegram from the center relaying reliable information that the shooting had been personally ordered by Gaddafi, and reporting that an experienced hitman from the Libyan intelligence station in East Berlin had been flown to London to oversee the shooting. Gordievsky immediately passed the telegram to MI6, which reinforced the argument for a strong response. The Thatcher government broke off diplomatic relations with Libya, expelled Gaddafi's thugs, and effectively expunged Libyan terrorism from Britain. Intelligence sometimes matures slowly. Gordievsky had first alerted MI6 to the espionage activities of Arne Treholt back in 1974. But it took the Norwegian Security Service a decade to act, partly to protect the source. In the meantime, the glamorous star of the Norwegian left had risen to become head of the press section at the Norwegian Foreign Ministry. Early in 1984, Gordievsky was told that the Norwegians were ready to swoop. He was asked if he objected. Since he had provided the first tip-off, his security might be compromised if Treholt was apprehended. Gordievsky did not hesitate. Of course, he is a traitor to NATO and Norway, so of course you must arrest him as soon as possible. Treholt was detained at the Oslo airport on January 20, 1984, by the chief of Norwegian counterintelligence. He was believed to be heading for Vienna to meet Gennady the Crocodile Titov, his KGB handler and lunch partner for the previous 13 years. Some 65 classified documents were found in his briefcase. Another 800 documents were found in his home. Initially, he denied spying, but when shown a photograph of himself with Titov, he vomited violently and then said, "What can I say?" Titov was also intercepted by the Norwegian intelligence service, which offered him a deal. If he agreed to change sides or defected to the West, he would be paid $500,000. He refused and was thrown out of the country. At his trial, Treholt was accused of inflicting irreparable damage on Norway by passing secrets to Soviet and Iraqi agents in Oslo, Vienna, Helsinki, New York, and Athens. He was accused of receiving $81,000 from the KGB. Newspapers described him as the greatest traitor to Norway since Quisling, the wartime Nazi collaborator, whose name became an English noun meaning traitor. The judge observed that he harbored unrealistic and exaggerated opinions about his own importance. He was found guilty of treason and sentenced to 20 years in prison. In the late summer of 1984, James Spooner moved to another posting and was succeeded as case officer by Simon Brown, the Russian-speaking former head of the Soviet section, P5, who had tailed Bettany disguised as a tramp. Brown had been inducted into the Nocton case back in 1979, when, as station chief in Moscow, he had been responsible for monitoring the signal sites for Pimlico, the escape operation. There was not the same immediate personal chemistry Gordievsky had enjoyed with Spooner. During their first encounter, Veronica provided celery for lunch, and put the kettle on. Brown was nervous. I thought, if I don't speak fluent Russian, he's going to think I'm an idiot. Then, when I played back the tape, to my horror, all I could hear was the rising whoosh from a boiling kettle and the crunch of a man eating celery. The MI6 secretary, Sarah Page, was always present at such meetings, quietly unflappable and reassuring. Her calming presence did much to humanize and gently soothe the somewhat fraught atmospherics. Meanwhile, Gordievsky continued with his day job, the cultivation of political contacts, some of them genuine Soviet sympathizers, and some, like Rosemary Spencer, providing useful chicken feed. The researcher at the Conservative Central Office was not the only controlled access agent. Unaware that Gordievsky was really a double agent working for British intelligence, being used by MI5 to feed him information. Neville Beale, a Tory member of the Greater London Council for Finchley and former chairman of the Chelsea Conservative Association, was another. He provided Gordievsky with council documents that were non-confidential and quite boring, but were further evidence of his skill in extracting official information. The centre frequently came up with suggestions for possible recruits, most of them entirely impractical and unlikely. In 1984, a personal telegram arrived from the centre, instructing Gordievsky to reconnect with Michael Foot, the former agent Boot. After his crushing election defeat, Foot had stepped down as Labour leader, but he remained an MP and a leading figure of the left. The telegram noted that although Foot had had no interaction with the KGB since the late 1960s, it might be useful to re-establish contact. If it emerged that a spy run by MI6 was actively trying to recruit one of Britain's most senior political figures, the fallout would be spectacular. Drag your feet, MI6 advised. Get out of it if you can. Gordievsky sent a message back to the centre, saying he would contrive to speak to Foot at a party, gently reveal a knowledge of his past contacts, and sound out his sympathies. Then he did nothing at all, and hoped the centre would forget about the idea, which it did, for a time. In the first 2 years, the Nocton case produced thousands of separate intelligence and counterintelligence reports, some only a few sentences long, others running to many pages. These were further divided up and parcelled out, to MI5, Margaret Thatcher, parts of Whitehall and the Foreign Office, and increasingly the CIA. Other selected allies received occasional counterintelligence leads, but only when important interests were at stake. The CIA was in a special favored nation category. MI6 was mightily pleased with Gordievsky, and so was the KGB. The bosses in Moscow were impressed by the steady stream of information he was producing as head of the PR line. MI6 was providing him with enough interesting information among the chicken feed to keep the KGB fat and satisfied. Even Gook was happy with him, unaware that his successful underling was about to bring his own espionage career to an ignominious end. The trial of Michael Bettany opened at the Old Bailey on April 11, 1984, under the tightest possible security, with court windows masked, a large police presence, and a scrambler telephone link to MI5 headquarters should consultation be necessary during proceedings. The evidence was so secret that most of the trial took place in camera, without public or reporters present. Bettany wore a pinstriped suit and a spotted tie. He insisted that his motivation had been pure and ideological. He was not a homosexual, not being blackmailed, and not working for profit. After 5 days of testimony, Bettany was sentenced to 23 years in prison. "You have made treachery your course of action," said Lord Lane, the Lord Chief Justice, pronouncing the sentence. "It is quite plain to me that in many ways you are puerile. It is also clear to me that you are both opinionated and dangerous. You would not have hesitated to disclose names to the Russians, which would almost certainly have led to death for more than one person." The press accepted Bettany's self-description as a communist spy because it was easier to understand a man who had undergone a gradual but eventually overwhelming political conversion. The newspapers saw in Bettany what they wanted to see. "Tweedy Twit became a wicked traitor," shouted the Sun. The intelligence Cold War never diminishes, said the Times. The Daily Telegraph tied itself in homophobic knots, trying to imply he was gay, and therefore implicitly untrustworthy. Bettany appeared to have enjoyed the company of the arty homosexual college community. The left-leaning Guardian was the most sympathetic. In his own mind, he was using his position in MI5 to try to stop Britain and the Western Alliance tottering into a new world war. In Washington, the American establishment fretted and quietly sniggered at the way British intelligence had yet again fallen prey to internal espionage. The president is truly alarmed, said a White House spokesman. One CIA source told the Daily Express, "We have to wonder again about security in the British intelligence community." A subsequent inquiry by the Security Commission was damning of MI5's failure to detect the danger posed by the unstable Bettany. The Times even wondered whether the time had come to merge MI5 and MI6 into a single intelligence agency. After all, the KGB operates both at home and abroad. What none of the newspapers guessed was that MI5's first convicted traitor had been exposed by an MI6 spy inside the KGB. Gordievsky had saved Britain from an intelligence catastrophe, and once again paved the way for his own professional advancement. Arkady Guk was identified in court testimony as the KGB's head of station. The portly Russian general was photographed, leaving his Kensington home with a wife in winged spectacles. His picture was splashed over the front pages beneath the headline, "Guk the Spook." The blundering Soviet spy chief who had turned down the KGB's first opportunity since the Second World War to recruit a penetration agent inside the security service. Guk actually seemed to be enjoying the attention and was parading around like a film star. Here was the perfect opportunity to get rid of him, which would clear the way for Gordievsky to rise further up the KGB pecking order and increase his access to secret material. MI6 requested Guk's immediate expulsion. Whitehall had little appetite for another diplomatic row. There would be no second opportunity to get rid of the resident, pointed out Christopher Kerwin, the new director of counterintelligence and security, DCIS, at MI6. Guk had always been most careful not to become directly involved in KGB agent-running operations and is likely to be even more careful in the future. Some in MI5 also argued against the move, pointing out that a new post-security officer had just been deployed to Moscow who would certainly be thrown out in a tit-for-tat expulsion if Guk was given his marching orders. But that, MI6 insisted, was a price worth paying. With Guk out of the way and Nikitenko nearing the end of his posting, Gordievsky might eventually take over as KGB resident in London. The stakes are very high, argued one senior official. Nothing less than the chance of access to all, or practically all, the KGB operations against this country. A letter was drafted for Mrs. Thatcher to send to the Foreign Office, stating that since Guk had been identified publicly, he must be ejected. In a clever little detail, Guk was spelt G-O-U-K in the letter. That was how the Daily Telegraph, uniquely among British newspapers, spelled it. Mrs. Thatcher was a Telegraph reader. The hint to the Foreign Office was implicit. The Prime Minister had read about the Russian spy chief in her morning newspaper and wanted him out. So if the Foreign Office continued to block the expulsion, she would take it personally. The ploy worked. On May 14, 1984, Guk was declared persona non grata for activities incompatible with his diplomatic status and given a week to pack his bags and leave Britain. As expected, the Soviets immediately responded by kicking MI5's new appointee out of Moscow. A farewell party was held at the Soviet embassy on the evening before Guk's departure, with lashings of food and drink and a succession of speeches in honor of the departing resident. When it was Gordievsky's turn to speak, he ladled on the flattery. "I must have sounded just a touch too smooth, and very slightly insincere." Guk lurched up afterward and muttered, "You've learned a lot from the ambassador," whose talent for hypocritical speechifying was a running joke in the embassy. Although already quite drunk, Guk sensed that his underling was happy to see him depart. The next day, General Guk flew back to Moscow and vanished into complete obscurity. He had embarrassed the KGB by drawing attention to himself. That, far more than his extraordinary incompetence, was unforgivable. Leonid Nikitenko was named acting resident, and immediately began angling to make the appointment permanent. Gordievsky became his deputy, with increased access to the KGB station telegrams and files. MI6 was suddenly inundated with fresh intelligence. The ultimate prize was now within reach. If he could maneuver his way into the resident's office, the station's entire trove of secrets would be his for the taking. Only Nikitenko stood in the way. Leonid Nikitenko was one of the cleverest men in the KGB, and one of the few who saw his job as a vocation. He would go on to head Directorate K, the KGB's counterintelligence branch. One CIA officer who met him described a barrel-chested bear of a man, full of life. He loved the drama of the spy game, and there was no question he was good at it. He was at home in this secret universe and relished every moment, an actor on a stage that he had set for himself, playing a role that he had scripted. After more than 4 years in the UK, the yellow-eyed counterintelligence officer was overdue to be rotated back to Moscow, but Nikitenko had his sights set on the coveted role of resident. A KGB job abroad usually lasted 3 years, but the center was sometimes prepared to extend a posting, so he now launched a vigorous campaign to demonstrate that he was the best man for the job, or, more accurately, to show that Gordievsky was not. The two men had never liked each other. A war over the succession to Gook now began, all the more intense for being undeclared. MI6 wondered whether to intervene yet again and declare Nikitenko persona non grata, leaving Gordievsky a clear route to the top. The knock-on effect was working. In a pun on the code name for the case officers called it the knocked-on effect. The strategy was tempting. If Gordievsky could be levered into the top position, then his time in London would yield maximum results, and at the end of his posting, he could defect. But, after some debate, it was decided that expelling Nikitenko would be a step too far, and possibly counterproductive. Kicking out two KGB officers in quick succession was par for the course, given the febrile atmosphere of the times. Removing all three of Gordievsky's immediate bosses might look like a pattern. Maxim Parshikov, Gordievsky's closest colleague, noticed that his friend now seemed to get into his stride. From the moment he was promoted to deputy resident, Oleg seemed softened, liberated, and behaved more calmly and naturally. Some thought he was getting above himself. Mikhail Lyubimov, his friend and former colleague, was back in Moscow, trying to make a new career as a writer after his sacking. He and I exchanged letters, and I was upset when he didn't reply promptly, sometimes sending only one letter to two of mine. Power spoils people, and the deputy resident in London is a big shot. Lyubimov had no idea how busy his old friend was, doing two secret jobs at once, while scheming for another promotion. The family had settled happily in London. The girls were growing up fast, speaking fluent English and attending a Church of England school. A century earlier, Karl Marx himself had been astonished how quickly his own children adapted to life in Britain. The idea of leaving the country of their precious Shakespeare appalls them. They've become English to the marrow, said Mrs. Marx. Gordievsky was similarly surprised and delighted to find himself the father of two little English girls. Layla was also enjoying British life more and more. Her English improved, but it was hard to make English friends, as wives were forbidden to see British citizens unaccompanied. Unlike Gordievsky, permanently on edge among his colleagues, she mixed easily with others in the KGB fraternity, drinking tea and gossiping happily with the wives of other embassy staff. I grew up in a family of KGB officers, she once said. My dad was a KGB officer, my mother was a KGB officer. Almost everyone in our district, where I spent my youth, was employed by the KGB. The fathers of all my friends and classmates were KGB officers. Therefore, I never considered the KGB to be monstrous or associated with anything horrible. It was my whole life, my everyday life. She was proud of her husband's rapid promotion and encouraged his ambition to take over as resident. He often seemed preoccupied and occasionally stared intensely into the distance, as if locked on to another world. He bit his nails constantly. Some days he seemed particularly excited, wired taut with nervous stress. She put that down to the pressure of his important job. Gordievsky loved Layla's lack of inhibition, her vitality and dedication to family life. Her naive sweetness, her very lack of worldly suspicion, was an antidote to the contortions of subterfuge he was living through. He had never felt so close to her, despite the falsehood, known only to him, that kept them apart. "I was so happily married," he reflected. From time to time, he wondered whether he could let her in on his secret and draw her into a complicity that would make their union truthful and complete. She would find out eventually when and if he finally defected to Britain. When MI6 gently probed him on how his wife might react when that moment came, he was adamant. "She will accept it. She is a good wife." From time to time, he openly criticized Moscow in front of Layla. On one occasion, a little carried away, he described the communist regime as bad, wrong, criminal. "Oh, stop yakking," Layla snapped at him. "It's just chat. You can't do anything about it, so what point is there in talking about it?" Nettled, Gordievsky shot back, "Maybe I can do something. Maybe one day you will see that I was able to do something about it." Just in time, he reined himself in. "I stopped. I knew if I had continued I would have told her more, or given her a hint." Later, he reflected, she would not have understood. Nobody would have understood. Nobody. "I never told anyone else. It was impossible, strictly impossible. It was lonely. It was very lonely." There was a hidden solitude in the heart of his marriage. Gordievsky adored his wife, but he could not trust her with the truth. Layla was still KGB, and he was not. On holiday back in Moscow that summer, Oleg was summoned to the first chief directorate headquarters for high-level discussions about his future. Nikolai Gribin, the guitar-playing whiz kid he had gotten to know in Denmark, who now headed the British Scandinavian section, was friendliness itself and dangled two possible promotions, the role of deputy department head back in Moscow, or that of resident in London. Gordievsky politely but firmly indicated his preference for the latter job. Gribin advised patience. The closer anyone moves to the position of head of station, the greater the danger, the more intense the intrigues. But he pledged to give Gordievsky his full backing. The conversation moved on to politics, and Gribin spoke warmly about a bright new star in the communist firmament named Mikhail Gorbachev. The son of a combine harvester operator, Gorbachev had risen swiftly within the communist hierarchy, becoming a full Politburo member before the age of 50. He was widely tipped as the likely successor to the moribund Chernenko. The KGB, Gribin revealed, had come to the conclusion that Gorbachev was the best bet for the future. Margaret Thatcher had reached the same conclusion. Gorbachev had been identified as the energetic Russian leader she was hoping for, a reformist, a man of vision who had traveled outside the Soviet bloc, in contrast to the narrow-minded Soviet gerontocracy. The Foreign Office had put out feelers, and in the summer of 1984, Gorbachev accepted an invitation to visit Britain the following December. Charles Powell, Mrs. Thatcher's private secretary, told her the visit presented a unique opportunity to try and get inside the minds of the next generation of Soviet leaders. It was also an opportunity for Gordievsky. As head of political intelligence in the Residentura, he would be responsible for briefing Moscow on what Gorbachev should expect. As a British agent, he would also be briefing MI6 on Russian preparations for the visit. Uniquely in intelligence history, a spy was in a position to shape, even choreograph, a meeting between two world leaders, by spying for and reporting to both sides. Gordievsky could advise Gorbachev on what to say to Thatcher, while simultaneously suggesting what Thatcher might say to Gorbachev. And if the meeting went well, it would improve Gordievsky's chances of securing the post of resident, and the intelligence windfall that this would bring. The news that the Soviet leader-in-waiting was coming to London plunged the London KGB station into a ferment of preparations. Instructions from Moscow flooded in, demanding detailed information on every aspect of British life: political, military, technological, and economic. The continuing miners' strike was of particular interest. Would they win? How were they financed? Strikes, of course, were forbidden in the Soviet Union. The center wanted chapter and verse on what Gorbachev should expect from his British hosts, and what British intelligence might be planning by way of unpleasant surprises. When Khrushchev had visited London in 1956, MI6 bugged his hotel, monitored his telephone calls, and even sent a frogman to inspect the hull of the Soviet cruiser on which he had arrived. The legacy of mistrust ran deep on both sides. Gorbachev was a dedicated party member, a creation of the Soviet system. Thatcher was a strident opponent of communism, a philosophy she condemned as immoral and oppressive. "Is there conscience in the Kremlin?" she had asked a year earlier in a speech to the Winston Churchill Foundation in the United States. "Do they ever ask themselves what is the purpose of life? What is it all for?" No, their creed is barren of conscience, immune to the promptings of good and evil. History has framed Gorbachev as a liberal progressive, the future architect of glasnost, openness, and perestroika, restructuring, would transform the Soviet Union, setting in motion forces that would dismantle it. But little of that was visible in 1984. Thatcher and Gorbachev stood on opposite sides of a vast political and cultural gulf. A successful meeting was by no means guaranteed. Rapprochement would require some delicate diplomacy and surreptitious engineering. The KGB saw the visit to Britain as an opportunity to strengthen Gorbachev's hand. "Send us the best possible briefing," Gribin told Gordievsky. "That way it will look as though he has a superior intellect." Gordievsky and his team set to work. "We really rolled up our sleeves," recalled Maxim Parshukov, "producing in-depth memoranda on all fundamentally important aspects of British policy and details on all the British participants." Everything Gordievsky gathered for Nikitenko to pass to the KGB in Moscow, he also handed over to MI6. More than that, British intelligence fed Gordievsky with information to introduce into his reports to Moscow: subjects for discussion, possible points of agreement and disagreement, such as the miners' strike, and tips on how to interact with the personalities involved. Britain's intelligence service was effectively setting the agenda for the upcoming meetings, and briefing both sides. Mikhail and Raisa Gorbachev arrived in London on December 15, 1984, on a visit that would last 8 days. There was time for shopping and sightseeing, including a devout pilgrimage to the seat in the British Library where Marx wrote Das Kapital. But the visit was, in essence, an extended diplomatic demarche, as the Cold War adversaries cautiously sounded each other out in a series of meetings at Chequers, the Prime Minister's country residence. Every evening, Gorbachev demanded a detailed memorandum of 3 or 4 pages, with a forecast of the line the next day's meeting would take. The KGB did not have that information, but MI6 did. Here was a perfect opportunity to ensure the two teams were on the same page, while demonstrating Gordievsky's value to his Moscow bosses. MI6 obtained the Foreign Office briefing document drawn up for Geoffrey Howe, the Foreign Secretary, listing the points he would be raising with Gorbachev and his team. This was then handed over to Gordievsky, who dashed back to the KGB station, hurriedly typed it up into Russian, and handed it over to the reports officer to put into the daily memorandum. "Yes," said Nikitenko when he read it. "This is just what we need." Geoffrey Howe's Foreign Office briefing had become Mikhail Gorbachev's KGB briefing. In it went, verbatim. Gorbachev's visit to Britain was a resounding success. For all their ideological differences, Thatcher and Gorbachev appeared to be on the same wavelength. Of course, there were moments of strain. Thatcher lectured her visitor on the merits of free enterprise and competition. Gorbachev insisted the Soviet system was superior, and invited her to see for herself how joyfully the Soviet peoples lived their lives. They sparred over the fate of dissidents, including the physicist Andrei Sakharov, and the arms race. In a particularly tense exchange, Thatcher accused the USSR of funding the miners, Gorbachev denied it. The Soviet Union had transferred no funds to the NUM, he said, before shooting a sideways glance at his propaganda chief, a member of the Soviet delegation, and adding, "As far as I know." That was a lie, and Mrs. Thatcher knew it. Back in October, Gorbachev himself had personally signed off on a plan to provide the striking miners with